Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 172. As promised, I indicated that we would do a quick recap of some of the more important topics that were covered and revealed in the last three episodes by Joan Mellon and her interviewers. There's well over 2 hours of programming, and so for that reason alone, it's easy to get distracted while listening to the original broadcast, which you did hear in its entirety, by the way. A broadcast that is about 18 years old now as I speak. A broadcast of the radio show Taking Aim, and which is produced by WBAI in Brooklyn, New York, featuring its two interviewers, Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, and of course, Joan Mellon herself. Ralph Schoenman's background is covered more fully in a previous episode. The radio show was a fresh revelation back in the day as Joan prepared to launch her new book, A Farewell to Justice. Oh, and by the way, the full title of the book is A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. Not every fact that Joan Mellon brings into the conversation in these episodes is without some form of controversial opposition, and probably for the same reason or reasons that I've pointed out in prior episodes about the entire Garrison investigation. Ms. Mellon researched this book meticulously, as you have heard a couple of times already, interviewing over 1,000 witnesses, which was an incredible feat in and of itself. And, as I've pointed out in the past, she is a pro-Garrison supporter, but not without doing her homework first. Did all the witnesses tell her the truth? Probably not. Some of them were scoundrels in their own right. Did she make her way fairly well through what I call the slog? That is, figuring out who was telling the truth and who was not, and what to write and say as a result? I think she did. Although with any bias comes an element of naivete and willingness to believe as truth what you want to hear, and play down those things that you don't. Still, I think Joan gets us the closest to the truth here that we are possibly ever going to get, as inexact as it is likely to be. And as for that controversial opposition, well, it is like an underlying current, so to speak, something that existed and was there long before her book, and rather sadly, it's a residual clandestine opposition to the truth that remains present even as of today. And nobody really knows exactly where it's all coming from, or, in this day and age, still why. Again, I refer to it more pejoratively as the slog, by the way, if you've been listening to prior episodes in the Garrison series, wading through statement after statement made by various parties about the same topic in order to determine the real facts, because detractors of the truth have muddied the waters with so much of their own disinformation, their own rewriting of the narrative to suit their objective. And that slog was, of course, incredibly strong and at its zenith in the day when Garrison himself was probing. At that moment, the government was hell-bent on destroying his case, and it didn't take much. As Garrison himself said, he was a chicken shit DA from Louisiana. What chance did he have against the entire force of the federal government? But the point here is that these are not definitive facts. These are all puzzle pieces, some rather imperfectly developed in the research community, but developed nevertheless, as good as they will ever be, I think. There is enough of them now, when considered together, to perhaps solve the puzzle. And people like Joan Mellon dedicated a serious part of their lives at a critical moment when witnesses were still alive, and perhaps during a unique period of time, far enough after the events themselves that these witnesses might still talk one more time before they passed. Memories faded, perhaps, but with a greater resolution to tell more and to tell the truth. Joan Mellon was in the right place at the right time, and the puzzle pieces that she has contributed all point to a commonality that this was a conspiratorial exercise with many players that must have been organized in a fashion that allowed for compartmentalization of component parts. Without concluding anything, it's very clear that this kind of construct is the kind that you might see perpetrated by an organization such as the CIA, or at least individuals trained in the ways of the CIA. And by the way, to a lesser degree, also the Mafia. I'm not concluding anything here. I'm just saying that is what this batch of evidence says to me when it's presented. I will repeat that I said an organization like the CIA, or individuals trained in its ways. That is an important distinction, ultimately, that we have to ponder. Meaning, was it simply a rogue element of radical CIA officers that broke off to involve themselves in this, if in fact they did? Or was it planned at much higher levels and truly was an institutional endeavor? We've heard a major amount of evidence so far through 171 episodes, and I think that would lead you to pondering that question very seriously. And of course, we have much more to come, much more specifically on the CIA element of it. That question of whether the CIA was involved at all, and then of course whether it was an institutional endeavor or a rogue endeavor, that question is central to the core of all of this. And again, it's a very important distinction ultimately that we have to ponder, a rogue element or an institutional endeavor. I know I'm repeating myself here, but I'm doing it deliberately. This is a paradigm I want you to grab hold of. You heard some very startling and matter-of-fact statements about who gave the orders in the CIA for this. And those were comments according to Ralph Schoenman, who stated them very strongly. And to some extent, they were an echo of what Mellon was saying herself. One thing is for sure, Joan Mellon has topics that she has pointed out that have been on our list of episodes for a while. So, during the recap, I will try to point out which of those topics will be covered by a future episode of JFK, The Enduring Secret, and covered in more detail, as we usually do. One more final topic before we get to today's recap episode itself. A while back, I opened up a YouTube channel for JFK, The Enduring Secret. I recorded a small trailer. That's about the only thing on the channel. I've never moved ahead with it. A few of you in the listening audience have explored it and signed up, so thank you for that. It now has just a handful of subscribers. I am going to ask a small favor of all of you. I don't run any ads on this podcast as I see it as an educational exercise for all of us as citizens and individuals all around the world with a vested interest in our history and the health of our democracy and our rights as citizens. And I would like to keep it that way. So, would each of you go to YouTube and subscribe to the YouTube channel JFK, The Enduring Secret? Again, I don't have any content, so to speak, on it yet, but I hope to begin adding small video recorded snippets in the near future, small vignettes that include the most compelling and provocative elements of what we are covering here, but with more side commentary. And of course, there are times when a picture or a video clip is worth a thousand words in the discussion. Think of it perhaps similar to what Joan Mellon did in this broadcast as compared to what she did with the book, an added richness of thought. Oh, and finally, my thanks to a couple of our listeners, which include one of my close doctor friends. Thank you for the minor spelling and pronunciation corrections on the last couple of episodes. I had a few errors, and where applicable, I revised the spelling that is contained in the podcast descriptions in the again in the last couple of episodes. Oops, sorry about that. As always, I truly appreciate the feedback and the help in getting every little detail right. Remember, I am an N of one, and I research, write, and produce the podcast myself. So occasionally, as you know, life gets in the way, and I end up hustling through things and make a mistake or two. And I do try very diligently to avoid that, but every once in a while, I have one. You may or may not have noticed this, but on a recent production, I missed one of my standard QA steps and accidentally left a music artifact right in the middle of my conversation. After posting the episode, I caught it quick enough, but for those of you who download immediately the podcast episodes, you've got one that has that artifact in it. You can treat it like that stamp, that collectible stamp from about 100 years ago with the upside-down airplane in the middle. Yeah, a real collector's item. Or you can simply download it again over the top of your existing episode because it's correct now. But if it didn't bother you then, I wouldn't worry about it now. No extra downloads needed. Oh, and that reminds me, if you're not subscribed to the podcast, then please do. Go to your favorite podcast provider and subscribe to JFK, The Enduring Secret. It's always helpful, and it helps to move up the podcast in a way, and so it allows for other potential followers of the podcast to discover more easily JFK, The Enduring Secret. So, without further ado, let's listen to episode 172 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. One of the most important connections was introduced early in this three-part series, and it was introduced by Ralph Schoenemann himself. Rush to Judgment, the book by Mark Lane, was written in Ralph Schoenemann's flat in London in connection with the Who Killed Kennedy Committee. It places Schoenemann in the thick of the original research investigation. I thought that was an interesting little historical tidbit that remains unknown to most of us. It tells a little bit more of the story of Mark Lane. Joan Mellon had a great line early in the broadcast. She said, "People wonder why there were not loose ends and why people didn't say anything." Well, as Joan says, there were lots of loose ends and some folks did make comment, and that is what comes out in her work. And in interviewing 1,000 witnesses, she found out about a lot of loose ends. Ralph Schoenemann, one of the interviewers, tries hard right off the bat to emphasize his own beliefs as they are well represented in Joan's work, that the head of the intelligence services, the CIA, and military intelligence all collectively are responsible for the execution of the president. I do believe, though, that his forceful attempt to state that all of this is true without any shadow of a doubt is tempting, although, as we know, it's the result of 1,000 pieces of the puzzle blown to bits initially and then all stitched back together by all of these inquiries and investigative exercises. For myself, I'm going to reserve a conclusion, as you know, until we get to the very end of JFK, The Enduring Secret. It's interesting that the book started out as a biography of Garrison, and then morphed into a biography of the Garrison investigation itself. And then finally, for Joan Mellon, it became an investigation of her own. And I think that is really critical, that last part, an investigation of her own. No one has interviewed 1,000 witnesses in conjunction with this case. No one, I believe, outside of the FBI. She tells the story of one witness who helped her to see Lee Harvey Oswald's connection to U.S. Customs. And those records, by the way, have yet to be reproduced, as she mentioned. Oswald's connection to Customs is not well known. Most of the questions surround his clandestine connection to the FBI as an informant and to the CIA, or Naval Intelligence. We should take note of that and get some sort of update in a later episode. Perhaps some of those were released after the release of this book. If any of you in the listening audience have seen anything on his connection to U.S. Customs, please do go to the website and put something down, or just email me directly at podcastjfk@gmail.com. Joan Mellon tells the story of how she interviewed one of Clay Shaw's friends, and it turns out that the wife of this friend had actually gone to junior high with Lee Harvey Oswald, and there were many stories. And in turn, Juan Valdez turned out to be a neighbor of that wife. Juan Valdez was the chief suspect in the murder of Mary Sherman. That's a great story, but we're going to cover the Mary Sherman matter separately in another episode, so I'm not going to say anything about it right now. To me, one of the more fascinating revelations is Joan Mellon got to spend time with Ann Dischler. As we have explained in past episodes, Dischler worked closely with Francis Frugier on the Kennedy investigation for Garrison. Those two were the investigative team in that neck of the woods of Louisiana, and she and Frugier knew more about the firsthand evidence obtained through their interrogation of witnesses and the stories gathered in that part of Louisiana, more so than anyone else. Initially, Dischler was not wanting to cooperate with Mellon because Dischler had been betrayed by another author previously. I wonder who that was. But Joan Mellon cracked the code with Ann Dischler, and Dischler ended up letting Mellon look at her notes, written in a sort of shorthand and taken contemporaneously during the original 1967 investigation. Those notes are likely to be the record of the event in those moments. Wouldn't it be nice if they were more widely available? Joan Mellon points out Frank Silva, whom she deems to be the medical director. The medical director in 1963 at East Louisiana State Hospital. Although I am somewhat confused by that title, as we have already named at least one person in another episode as the head clinician in that building at that time. At any rate, he was a doctor of importance there. And there is a fascinating story told by Silva to Mellon that completely counteracts the idea that Oswald was a communist. There, as Silva witnessed, Oswald stated that he was going to kill Castro. There was more background in history related to Clay Shaw, stating that almost from the very beginning, out of the military, after World War II, he was connected to CIA entities that were operating in New Orleans. He joined Mississippi Shipping, which was a CIA entity, and then that led to his employment at the International Trade Mart. He was a high school dropout, as Joan noted, and knew nothing of economics, yet he was given a high position in an entity that promoted international trade, primarily because the New Orleans Trade Mart and others like it were CIA fronts. When the CIA called Shaw to watch Oswald, he was not necessarily jumping up and down for joy. But as Joan put it, he was loyal to the CIA and he fulfilled the role they asked him to play. A limited one, by the way, from Joan's perspective. I thought that the comments about Perry Russo and how he actually came to go to the press first were notable because Joan shreds that myth. She tells the story of how Russo wanted to tell his story to the sheriff right there in Baton Rouge, and that Russo actually talked to the sheriff first, by the way. But the sheriff in Baton Rouge didn't want to hear it, which is why Russo then went to a Baton Rouge newspaper at the suggestion of the sheriff. That one explained a lot for me, because if it's true, and I assume it is, that reduces my suspicion that Russo was simply publicity mongering from the very beginning. This points to the idea that he absolutely was not publicity mongering in those early moments. The alibi story of Ferry, Shaw, and Oswald was discussed. It was important to hear Joan state that Perry Russo heard those alibi locations prior to November 22nd. And in fact, Shaw and David Ferry actually were at those locations on November 22nd. Exactly as previously discussed in front of Russo at a party at David Ferry's. Ferry ended up at Southeast Louisiana University in Hammond, Louisiana, and Clay Shaw was in San Francisco. One thing that is absent in the discussion is that she doesn't address the lie detector tests and simply emphasizes the sodium pentothal event when it comes to Russo. She avoided the controversy of that on the Taking Aim show. I wish she would have addressed that head on. She introduces Robert Burris, a New Orleans policeman who drew the sketch likeness of Clay Shaw, and a person she became to know and admire, and actually dedicated the book to. Burris would later become an investigator for the HSCA on the Kennedy case. She introduces another topic that we will most certainly address in a separate episode, the CIA program that used the acronym QK and CHANT. The program that Clay Shaw was operating under and used it to employ Guy Bannister. That's QKNCHANT. She points to QK and CHANT as proof that Shaw was definitively an active member of the CIA, with Shaw engaging in more than the program that has been previously disclosed about him, that is the Domestic Contact Service engagement. She states that KQ and CHANT allowed for those participating in it to recruit other independent players into the CIA through the KQ and CHANT function. They were sort of a cutout organization and group of people for that purpose. And Shaw, she states, was the only member of this group in New Orleans. So, by definition, he had to have known Bannister, as there are existing records that show Bannister's recruitment into that program in New Orleans. She chronicles statements made by such CIA titans as Ray Rocha, who was nicknamed The Rock by James Angleton. He had telephoned John Dempsey, another CIA employee, and he revealed how aware he was of Clay Shaw as a CIA operative. And Joan came across this. There was a lengthy discussion on how the Fair Play for Cuba Committee was heavily infiltrated, and that infiltration was a project of David Atlee Phillips. Imagine that. One more string to connect. Okay, everyone in the podcast audience, have you seen the show Homeland? Remember when the star CIA analyst places pictures of suspects all over the wall and they draw strings between the connections? I've mentioned this before, but it's a great way to project and see the connections between all these parties. If we were to do it today, with all these JFK suspects and witnesses, it would undoubtedly give us a great visual on how connected all these people were, if not directly, clearly indirectly. That is an exercise that someone should be doing. I'm sure the CIA does it today using some form of sophisticated proprietary software. As I mentioned earlier, clearly Oswald was working for U.S. Customs, but those records remained sealed. However, the summaries of those interviews were available to Joan Mellon at the National Archives, and Joan used them. We'll speak a little more on the U.S. Customs connections in a later episode. Joan Mellon revealed that Jim Garrison was inspired by Representative Hale Boggs, not the popular story about his plane ride with Russell Long. Why is that important? Well, Boggs himself was on the Warren Commission. Boggs told Garrison about the closed-door session in which the Warren Commission members were told about Oswald's connection to the FBI. You see, from the very start, Garrison heard from the very top that something was awry. I love the story tell about William Walther. He was a young Tulane student in 1963, and he was working at the FBI offices. As we know, Oswald was arrested in New Orleans in the midst of the scuffle with Carlos Brignere and others as Oswald was handing out Fair Play for Cuba pamphlets. When he got to the police station, he handed Officer Martello a note. It contained instructions stating that he should call the FBI. Martello was pretty tight-lipped about all of that until he later talked about it in the 1990s. And it's interesting, the story of it all. What happened next involved William Walther. Walther answered the phone at the FBI offices and took Martello's request about Oswald. But the only FBI agent on duty at that moment was an agent named John Quigley. And he instructed Walther to check the records to find out just who this Oswald was. A man who clearly was implying that he was an FBI operative or informant. And as far as records go, at the FBI in New Orleans that summer, there were plenty. On one such record, which William Walther saw on the jacket of one file containing information about Lee Harvey Oswald, was the name of Warren DeBries, one of the FBI agents there in New Orleans. He was a tough old bird by the time Mellon interviewed him, but he was finally saying something. And he hadn't said anything for the longest of time. And for the longest of time, DeBries denied ever even knowing Oswald, which makes sense in light of what we now know the FBI was trying to do at the time, to hide its association with Oswald. DeBries told Mellon, in a nutshell, that he would not be a very intelligent person if he never changed his mind. That was as close as Joan Mellon got to an admission that he had lied about Oswald all those years. An admission, yes, that he had known Oswald. There is a taped session in Garrison's office where they had the startling revelation about what 544 Camp Street meant. That is the stamp on the Fair Play for Cuba pamphlets. There were Cubans in Garrison's office at the time, and apparently a taped conversation of that exists. We should explore that. Wouldn't that be a great conversation to put on the podcast? Joan Mellon reveals that Jack Martin was a CIA operative, which is surprising a bit to me. She thinks that the pistol whipping that Bannister gave Martin in the office there at 544 Camp Street, and which occurred on the day of the assassination, may very well have been over Martin stealing the file on Lee Harvey Oswald. He was made out to be a drunk by so many, but in fact, Joan Mellon states that Jack Martin was quite a capable person mentally. And you know, that does show in the one tape that I listened to when Garrison interviewed him in his office at the start of the investigation again in late 1966. She reveals a new witness, Alan Campbell, who worked for Guy Bannister. And Campbell is another eyewitness that has stated that Bannister met with Clay Shaw, and he did it often. As I mentioned earlier, Joan Mellon found a document where Bannister was recruited by KQ and Chant. Again, the program includes CIA operatives who were given authority to recruit others who are not part of the agency. And again, Shaw was the only KQ and Chant member in New Orleans, so the document that shows Bannister being recruited intrinsically links Bannister to Shaw and is corroborative to what Alan Campbell stated to Joan Mellon in terms of eyewitness testimony. Ralph Schoenman clearly points the fingers at Richard Helms and James Jesus Angleton as the high-level culprits in this whole scheme to kill the president. We won't comment on that right now. That has to wait for other episodes. But keep it in mind. Remember, I have asked the seminal question. If it was CIA, was it a group of rogue CIA officers involved? Or was it carried out institutionally from the very top of the organization? At least at the very top of clandestine operations. It's a key question for us all to ponder and, of course, explore more. That is, if you're getting to the point now of asking such a question. Joan revealed a more human side to Corey Collins. You remember him from an earlier episode? You should know him as the black mailman in Clinton, who was the head of the Corps at the time. Joan really got to know and love him for his courageous involvement. Remember Jesse Palmer, the head of voter registration there in Clinton? He failed Collins in his voter registration test because he answered all 10 of the questions. And you see, he only needed 6 out of 10. No joke. That was one way they denied voting rights in those days in the Deep South. Can you imagine? Joan Mellon tells the story of how the Ku Klux Klan used to meet regularly in the TV repair shop in town. Well, Corey Collins knew it, and he used to walk into the shop during the meetings just to let the Klan members know what he knew, and that was that he knew what they were doing there. He would go to New Orleans and testify for Garrison at the Shaw trial, and then be fired by the post office as they demanded he be back and delivering mail the very next morning in Baton Rouge, which is where he lived at the time. And they knew he couldn't make it back in time to do that. As Mellon tells the story, and sadly, as I said, the post office fired him for what she believes was an obvious retaliation for his having testified. Collins never told Jim Garrison that he was fired from the U.S. Post Office. Mellon wondered why, but she knew this proud man was not going to lay that on Garrison's doorstep. Collins would also stare down a lynch mob, helping another black man avoid a lynching that almost took place, where they would have released the man from the jail, and of course the mob, the angry mob, would have taken him away and lynched him. Corey Collins got them to keep the man in jail, the only safe place for that man to be at that moment. You see, these stories are important because there was real fear in the air then. And unless you lived it, you really can't imagine it. It would be hard to understand how hard it was for people to come forward in those types of situations and participate in a trial or any legal proceeding. Look, not that everyone was afraid. I am not trying to paint that picture. But I am trying to say that in certain cases, it could be much more dangerous and difficult for a witness. It's interesting that Joan Mellon states that Lawrence Houston, who was head of the legal office of the CIA, was quite involved in the assassination. We should try to explore that more. That certainly leads to a question of how involved the other higher-ups were, if he was indeed actively engaged. This seems to be related to his active diversion of witnesses away from the Clay Shaw trial. While I agree that is nefarious, it may not be directly related to implicit involvement in the assassination plot itself. We need to explore more how Joan came to that conclusion, more than the small amount that she shared on the program itself. One of the biggest discoveries that Joan Mellon made relates to the plane that was to be used to go to Dallas and carry folks out. David Ferry applied for a loan to rent a plane, and he did that just a short time before the assassination, and it was, guess what, co-signed by Clay Shaw. Yes, they really did know each other. You see, she tells the story of a former police officer from Kenner who knew a loan officer named Herb Wagner. One night, Wagner and the officer were together, and Wagner said to the police officer, "I have something that I think should perhaps be shared with Garrison." It turned out to be the application for the loan on the airplane, where Ferry was the applicant and Clay Shaw was a co-signer of the loan. Well, Wagner died before Joan heard this story, and later Joan tracked down Wagner's family to the police officer and talked to Wagner's wife. And unfortunately, the wife had meticulously gotten rid of Wagner's files after his death. And so the loan document itself was gone, but the story was nevertheless revealed. Mellon went into a great deal of depth in how deeply the Garrison investigation was penetrated. Walter Sheridan applied destructive forces in so many ways and venues, and the wiretapping, blackmail, and bribery were just three broad categories in his tool bag. She portrays Sheridan as a thug himself, a rather sophisticated one, but still a thug. It probably was what was necessary, I suppose, to get Jimmy Hoffa. And they did. She tells the story that when Hoffa's bribery case got to the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Earl Warren wanted to let Hoffa go because of the methods that Sheridan had used to entrap Hoffa. I'm happy that Joan didn't try and defend Hoffa since he himself was a bigger thug. A real thug. She says that she has the tapes where Russo was wired and met with Walter Sheridan. There was no law at the time against obstruction of justice, so Garrison couldn't charge Sheridan with that particular offense, so he ended up having to charge Sheridan in other ways. And he did. And we'll explore more of that in the context of Hoffa as well in later episodes. She called Dean Andrews another mob lawyer. It was a more explicit tie to the mob than I had heard Andrews describe before, but maybe that's something we can explore more on the Dean Andrews episode, that Garrison refused to use some of the folks in the New Orleans area that knew about Clay Shaw being Clay Bertrand, and he refused to use them because of their sexual preference. It's an interesting thought, and Mellon uses it to paint a rather idyllic view of Garrison. Others see a darker side of Garrison around that topic, but I will just leave it at that for now. She speaks about Gordon Novell, but I'll leave that to a later episode as well, except that she does tell the brief point that Marlene Mancuso, Gordon Novell's ex-wife, was quite beautiful, and she was formerly a Miss New Orleans. Walter Sheridan offered Marlene a part on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and he did it as a bribe. If only Marlene would take back the testimony on the robbery at HOMA. We're going to cover the HOMA robbery separately as well. Joan Mellon thinks that David Atlee Phillips was involved in the assassination, like so many others think, although she's not clear on exactly what his involvement might have been. She does remind us that David Atlee Phillips wrote in his memoirs about the AMLASH legacy. A researcher saw some of it during a deposition, but Phillips' wife was trying to keep that under wraps. Some people think that was a bit of a confession. She talks about the fact that Jim Garrison really wanted to investigate George Brown and Brown and Root. Yes, the whole military-industrial complex theory that so many conspiracy supporters buy into. I do believe you always follow the money, and there is no doubt truth to this theory. But I still find it hard to believe that the president was shot for just this reason. Was it a byproduct that made complicity with something easier? Probably. But I don't think it was the prime motive in my mind. Maybe that's just naivete on my part. She does not believe that Lyndon Johnson was involved in the assassination. However, she does not comment on whether he might have been aware of a plot. That is a question I would be interested in asking Joan about directly. You know, her late book, Faustian Bargain, deals with Mack Wallace and others. So let's hold that until we get to him. The House committee attempted to discredit James Wilcott, who was a CIA accountant/finance officer who had claimed that he had made payments to Lee Harvey Oswald off the CIA paymasters. But this discrediting that the HSCA did was done rather lamely. In the end, Joan Mellon believes that Wilcott was probably telling the truth about the incidents. I said earlier that I wasn't going to say anything about Mary Sherman, but maybe I'll say something. Mary Sherman was found dead in New Orleans, and that really does deserve a separate episode. But she was clearly working for Dr. Ochsner, and Ochsner was definitely connected to the CIA, and he knew Shaw. This is another one where strings tied between participants, photos on the wall, will yield more in later discussions, so stay tuned. Oh, then there is Eladio Del Valle, probably David Ferry's handler at the CIA. I mentioned this before, but let's say it again. He was found dead in Miami with a hatchet in the head, or at least a hatchet wound in the head, about exactly the same time that David Ferry died in New Orleans. What a coincidence. More to come on that one. Eladio Del Valle, that is. Gladys Palmer was a stripper for Jack Ruby, and Lee Harvey Oswald was seen with her. In fact, they were seen quite frequently together in the summer of 1963. Where was Marina? Regardless, draw another string. Did all these people just randomly connect with each other? This book is chock full of witnesses who saw Ruby and Oswald together, by the way. That is why I urge you to buy the book and read it in its entirety. You won't want to put it down. Frank Carlucci was another person that is pointed out to be a central figure that we should learn more about and that perhaps we should feature at least a portion of a podcast on. As I mentioned earlier, she highlights the plants into Garrison's team. And you know, during the House Select Committee assassination investigation investigators were allowed to review the list of CIA plants in Garrison's office. Yes, the CIA had actually prepared a memo detailing such. The HSCA investigators were not allowed to copy it, but they were allowed to look at it. And so they could see all of them. Yes, folks, you really can't write this stuff. Oh, and then there is the perplexing overall story of why Robert Kennedy was so against the investigation. She was finished and the book was in proofs. So Joan Mellon took one more shot at finding out. She went to Miami. She spoke with Angelo Mercado, who later became Angelo Kennedy after he changed his name in deference to the Kennedy family. He was part of a group essentially working for Bobby Kennedy at the time, and they heard about things going on in New Orleans. So he went down to New Orleans, and he discovered the goings-on there and discovered, once they went down there, Lee Harvey Oswald. Jones states that they reported Lee Harvey Oswald and his activities to Robert Kennedy. Yes, Kennedy had heard Oswald's name well before the assassination. They were obviously concerned about his communist Fair Play for Cuba activities. But they also found out at the time that Lee Harvey Oswald was an FBI informant. Imagine that. And now Robert Kennedy knew it. But Robert Kennedy rather naively concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald was likely under control if he was an FBI informant. So, no further steps needed to be taken to eliminate any danger to the Kennedys. It turns out that Angelo Kennedy turns out to be one of the three men who visited with Sylvia Odio in that famous story. Two Cubans and a man named Leon Oswald in September 1963 who went to see Sylvia Odio asking for some help. Some help in organizing forces against Fidel Castro. One man at that meeting called himself Angelo, which, as Jones states, we now know is Angelo Mercado. And the other man was a man who called himself Leopoldo, whose name was not Leopoldo. A few days later, Leopoldo calls Sylvia back, alone, not with Angelo present. And he says, "Isn't that American crazy?" Leopoldo would state that the crazy American stated that some Cuban should kill Kennedy because of what happened at the Bay of Pigs. Obviously, making that statement to Sylvia was a complete setup of Oswald to later take the fall for the assassination. Or at least one more plant of evidence pointing in his direction. Joan Mellon claims that the person who made that call turns out to be a CIA asset named Bernardo de Torres. He was masquerading as a man named Leopoldo. Both he and Angelo Kennedy were Bay of Pigs veterans. Something Joan discovered is that when de Torres was interrogated by the HSCA, years later, the CIA lawyers had advanced discussions with the HSCA lawyers, and they made it very clear to them what they could and could not ask Bernardo de Torres under deposition. And one of those topics that they could not ask him about related to his activities just prior to the president's assassination. I wonder why they would make such a request. Angelo Mercado, or Angelo Kennedy, had huge affection for the Kennedy family, as described by Joan, and known generally. So from her perspective, he was not a person who would have been involved in any assassination plot against Kennedy. Joan Mellon interviewed Mercado years later, and he told her how sick he was the moment he saw on television that the man who had accompanied them to see Sylvia Odio was the man now accused of killing JFK. He too was used by the CIA. The long and the short of it, as it relates to RFK's opposition to the Garrison investigation, is that it would have revealed the separate RFK plots to kill Castro and the startling fact that RFK was aware of Lee Harvey Oswald prior to the assassination. It's an interesting thesis that RFK knew more about Lee Harvey Oswald, and we should explore that more in another episode. Joan Mellon tells the story of Richard K. Snagel, a story that we will tell separately, so I won't say much of anything about it here. It's fascinating, by the way. And I'm not going to tell it because I don't want to give too much away, except that Mellon states that Garrison thought that Snagel would have been the best witness in the trial. Snagel knew Ferry. He knew Shaw. And he, in his own view, that is, Snagel, felt that Richard Helms was behind the assassination. Richard K. Snagel, in a series of letters written at the time to a friend in Mexico, would show a deeper motive of the CIA executive elements, a deeper motive to eliminate Kennedy. Not so much because of his international policies, per se, but because of their fear that John F. Kennedy was really going to dismantle the capabilities of the CIA. Obviously a well-known theme in today's vernacular. We'll smash it into 1,000 pieces and all of that. But really not so much so publicly at the time. And that is why the Snagel correspondence is important to understanding who truly had the deepest motives to carry out the assassination. William Bishop, who was a CIA associate of Snagel, is cited by Mellon in discussions as having a corroboration of Snagel's comments that Helms and perhaps others at the head of the CIA's clandestine operations were behind the assassination. She mentions Jerry Patrick Hemming, as she spent time with him in Miami. But I'm not going to cover anything on Hemming because he deserves his own episode. You're getting tired of hearing that, aren't you? What a character that we have there. A soldier of mercy and teller of tall tales. Joan tells the story of Thomas Edward Beckham. He enters the story very early on through Jack Martin because Jack Martin mentions him as someone Garrison should look into. Garrison brought Beckham before the grand jury. Mellon tells the story of how he got there. It tells of a scene in Omaha where Beckham is moving between Nebraska and Iowa in an attempt to evade Garrison's subpoena. And there is a phone call between Beckham and Jack Martin, and Jack Martin tells him to go back to Nebraska. And then, on the way, Beckham gets caught doing just that. And then that requires him to come back to New Orleans and testify before the grand jury. Jack Martin had actually tried to have Beckham committed in his early years. Can you imagine that? Because he was a figure that no one would miss. He actually was a country singer, and he was singing country music under the name Mark Evans. He was part of something known as the Louisiana Hayride. When he came back to testify before the grand jury, he was asked about Guy Bannister, Clay Shaw, and Lee Harvey Oswald. And he lied under oath about knowing all three. And yet he was present at Algiers and at the Town and Country Hotel. Yes, the Town and Country Hotel, the headquarters of Carlos Marcello. What exactly was his role, you say? Well, you see, Beckham became connected with Jack Martin through Beckham's father. It was a relationship that his father had with Jack Martin. And Jack Martin had promised to help his friend find a singing career for his son. But in the meantime, Beckham in 1964 simply became a runner or errand boy of sorts in Bannister's office. That led to him becoming a courier for G. Ray Gill. And as you know, G. Ray Gill was counsel representing Carlos Marcello. And Mellon tells the story that a week before the assassination, Thomas Beckham was given an assignment to deliver a good deal of maps, diagrams, and materials about Dealey Plaza to be put into the hands of a CIA soldier of fortune named Lawrence Howard. At some point, Beckham was sent for training by the CIA. And sometime in 1963, he ended up with his own post office box in the same post office as Lee Harvey Oswald and others. His CIA handler was a guy named Fred Chrisman. And we'll spend more time on all of this in later episodes. Robert Buras, the former New Orleans policeman mentioned earlier, interviewed Beckham for the HSCA. Ralph Schoenman claims that Thomas Edward Beckham was being groomed as the second Patsy. As I said, during his grand jury testimony, Mellon states that Beckham lied about everything. Garrison called him after the grand jury testimony, and at the time, Beckham was with a man named A. Roswell Thompson, and he was a figure in the Ku Klux Klan in Louisiana. Garrison asked Beckham, "Was I close?" Beckham, still tight-lipped, refused to say much at that moment. But years later, when Joan Mellon interviewed Beckham, Beckham would say, "I wish I could have told him how close he really was." Beckham would later become a rabbi and, in effect, attempt to redeem himself to some extent related to his activities in those years and his conduct in earlier life. Mellon sensed that Beckham, too, was frightened, still frightened in his later years. Yes, he was a con man in his early years, and he was forever on the run after the assassination, seemingly concerned as well that the CIA was after him. I think I said that Beckham is worth a portion of an episode or more. Maybe we combine it with a whole discussion around the delivery of materials to Dallas that were used to help plan some of the details in Dallas. There was an extensive discussion on Paese Sierra. Much of it was conducted by Ralph Schoenman, but I'm not going to go into that right now, other than to say that Ralph talks at length how the media tried to discredit the Paese Sierra as something that had deep connections to the Russian communist apparatus, and therefore the statements were propaganda as they related to the Kennedy assassination. It was all aimed at discrediting the CIA, so the CIA or whoever planted that story would have you believe. Well, Schoenman and Joan Mellon were vehement in their staunch support of Paese Sierra as having told the truth. And they actually interviewed the editors of Paese Sierra themselves. And in all of that, stating an obvious point that Italy was left-leaning at the time, and this was a national newspaper that essentially represented the overall political position of the country's populace, and whose editors vehemently denied any connection to the communist regime in Russia. Not that they probably would have overtly stated that they were connected, but I think whatever they did gave Schoenman and Mellon confidence that they, in fact, were not part of that. Again, it's who do you believe and what do you believe? One thing that was kind of interesting is that the trademarks, both in Dallas and New Orleans, based on the discussion in the radio broadcast, were stated to have both had a connection to the CIA. This led to a discussion on the Cabells. That's right, General Cabell, who was fired as the number two man of the CIA after the Bay of Pigs. And as you know, his brother Earl was the mayor of Dallas at the time of the assassination. In 1989, Joan would see Garrison for the last time, and Garrison was still focused on the complex questions around the possible involvement of the Cabells in the assassination. There were other little snippets like Carl McNabb, who was a CIA contract pilot. He was another great character that they discussed. Oh, and one last little snippet on Robert Kennedy. Apparently, RFK sent Richard Goodwin down to No Name Key. That's a key in the chain of keys in Florida when you're eventually driving down to Key West. Goodwin was sent down there to enlist Jerry Patrick Hemming and his band of contract CIA soldiers to effectively change teams and work directly for RFK instead of the CIA and take over Radio Swan from the CIA, a project that you should know about if you listened to all the Cuba episodes previously on JFK, The Enduring Secret. But Jerry Patrick Hemming and his band of contract CIA soldiers ultimately refused that offer. They were loyal to the CIA. Folks, you can't write this stuff. Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, Carmel Offie, and Frank Wisner were portrayed as the Grand Masters, according to James Angleton, and comments that Mellon and Schoenman would make. Angleton would say that if you were in a room with these four men, then you were in a room with a group of men who most assuredly were going to hell. He would then say, "I guess I will see them there. Yes, the words and thoughts of James Angleton. A confession of sorts, maybe, at least to all the nefarious things that they were all involved with over the years at the CIA. Another semi-death confession came from Clay Shaw himself. A friend of Clay Shaw's who lived in the French Quarter, an artist named George Durow, would tell the story after Shaw's passing, relaying what Shaw told him, that Garrison was wrong, but someone like me might well have helped the CIA, perhaps have delivered a package, you know, aiding and abetting. Well, Joan Mellon would state that Shaw was certainly not a shooter, and certainly it was not his idea to murder the president, but certainly he was dutifully willing to participate when asked to do so. The theory there was that Clay Bertrand, or Clay Shaw, was totally beholden to the CIA. Similarly, David Atlee Phillips, estranged from his brother, but near death, also made a confession near the end. He talked to his brother, and what was said was eventually relayed to Joan through his brother's son, Sean. And that was that David Atlee Phillips essentially admitted that he was in Dealey Plaza and supervising that day on November 22nd in Dallas. So you see, there were many loose ends, and many people did talk. Mark Felt, yes, Deep Throat, was one of the folks in the FBI assigned to discrediting Garrison, and he worked with the Louisiana Attorney General's office, Jack P.F. Gramillion, in it to do so behind the scenes. Mellon found a friend of David Ferry's. His name was John Wilson. He was a person who had not talked previously to any governmental bodies and was not involved in any investigation or the selling of any books or videos. He was a fresh, unaccounted-for witness, and he, too, saw Oswald up in David Ferry's apartment. Yes, Russo was telling the truth. Wow. I don't know about you, but it's exhilarating to read a book like that. And that is really, honestly, just a snippet of what's inside the book itself. There'll be more to come on some of the witnesses and some of the stories that Joan has in A Farewell to Justice. But one thing is for sure, there are a lot of puzzle pieces that get filled in by the investigative work that Joan Mellon did. There are many other people who have done great work, and all of this has to be combined to understand and put into context the true picture. But hopefully, it's beginning to come into focus for all of us. I think it's time for a sandwich. Thank you for listening to episode 172 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.